This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 200 was recorded on Monday, December 30th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. Happy New Year. This episode of Macro Voices is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases. Dr. Pippa Malmgren is back for our final episode of the decade, and she gave us a terrific feature interview. Just like last week, we won't have a post-game segment this week, and that allowed us to let Pippa's final interview of 2019 run a little bit longer than usual. We'll start with the knowledge doubling curve and then move on to several other fascinating subjects. I think you're going to really enjoy this one, folks. We'll be back to our regular show format with a post-game segment and Thursday evening release schedule starting next week on January 9th, 2020.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, S&P 500 seems to have at least put in some sort of a short-term top on Friday. What's your take here?
Well, you know, there's lots of year-end effects to think about. The so-called January effect, which a lot of people talk about in markets, the idea behind that is that when you have tax selling at the end of a year, then the following January, people reinvest that money, start buying again, and oftentimes January outperforms the rest of the year. I think what might be going on here is kind of a reverse January effect, where we're up 25%. On the S&P this year. So there's not much tax loss selling. You know, if you're trying to sell your losers, most people don't have a whole lot of losers this year that they can take a loss on. And I think maybe what they're anticipating is that the selling is going to happen in January, where people want to wait to take profits until they get into a new tax year and can defer paying taxes on those profits. I think maybe people are starting to anticipate a sell-off at the beginning of January, which may have already begun because of tax reasons. That's pure speculation on my part. I haven't done any deep analysis, but that's my general guess as to why we might have this little change as of the last few days. Big picture, though, my view is unchanged from what I've said before. Central bank policy quantitative easing is going to continue to fuel this melt-up until it stops one day. The catalyst for that change, what's going to cause it to stop? That's really the big important question to think about. My guess is it's the politics changing to where QE money doesn't get used to buy bonds in the open market anymore. It gets used to pay for other things like universal basic income and free tuition and so forth. But that remains to be seen. But Patrick, I wanted to ask you about this because I know on Friday morning last week, which happened to be just as the market was topping, you issued an alert to your big picture trading members saying, hey, everybody, roll your calendared straddles up to the current strike price or up to the current market. That obviously proved so far to be a very prescient call. What was going on there? What motivated you to think, hey, right now is the time to emphasize to members to lock in these profits?
For sure, the markets were just roaring higher. And with that kind of gap higher up into 3250, there was a Fib measurement that we did up into that zone. At the same time, Charlie McElligott's big gamma wall numbers are all up in that 3250 strike on the S&P. So it was a logical place to make the adjustments. And we'll see how this develops. But I do agree with your idea that there's the year-end tax shift that could potentially develop. You know, somebody who bought Apple at the first quarter of the year at like between $150 to $170, and they're sitting on close to 100% gains on it. You know, deferring the sale of your stock into the new year makes a lot of sense. So it'll be interesting to see whether that dynamic develops there. All right, Eric, let's move on, though. Let's move to the dollar index, which has weakened considerably as the euro seems to be making a breakout attempt. What's your thinking on the dollar?
Well, needless to say, I'm glad to have gotten out of my longs on the dollar on the bounce last week. I still think Jeff Snyder has the right idea about the global dollar squeeze thesis. I think that is still operative. But hey, the tape is telling us the market doesn't want to move higher, at least on the dollar index, not right now. We now have an established pattern of lower highs and lower lows that's very clearly established. So I'm on the sidelines. I don't want to go short this market. I don't expect the dollar to crash. I think Jeff will eventually be proven right. But it seems like right now is not the time for Jeff to be right. So I'm on the sidelines.
All right. Well, let's move to crude oil because it just keeps edging higher every day. And nothing seems to be able to crack this. What's your thinking on oil?
Well, it's resoundingly clear to me that what's going on here, and I base this primarily on the commitment of traders reports and the ever-increasing open interest from managed money speculative longs in both Brent and WTI crude oil futures. What's going on here is long oil has become the fashionable trade for managed money. And I don't think these are professional oil traders. I think they're macro position traders. They're big funds. These are people who are following the macro signal of beginning signs of inflation, telling them that it's time to get long oil. These are people who don't look at the inventory reports every week. They're just looking for a long position on energy because they think from a sector rotation standpoint, it's the time to be there. Now, I agree with Art Berman that crude oil was already a little bit overpriced on a comparative inventory fair value basis. But frankly, it doesn't matter. Long oil is suddenly the fashionable trade. And if I look at Ola Hansen's commitment of traders reports, and I look at how much room there is before we get back to those extremes of net length in the COT reports that have proven to be a barrier before, there's lots of room to go. So I think the market can still go higher. That is, again, against what really is already an overvalued price on a fundamental basis, according to Art Berman's comparative value fair market analysis. So it's kind of a funny situation, but right now the fashionable trade is long oil. I think they're going to continue to take the market higher. I think it is setting us up to eventually reverse direction and move much lower, but I don't think we're there yet.
Eric, with the holiday, do we have the EIA reports?
Well, we do sort of, kind of. What's happened is EIA has delayed their reports because of the holidays out to Friday. And of course, we're producing the show early this week. So I do have the EIA inventory report from last Friday, but that's for the week ended December 20th, not December 27th. So we're off by a week from what we would normally be reporting. Crude oil drawing down 5.5 million barrels, bigger drawdown than expected. That's a bullish signal, helps to drive the price higher, which it has. Cushing, Oklahoma, also drawing down 2.4 million barrels, and that's becoming a trend of big drawdowns. Yes, it's true that the Keystone Pipeline operating at reduced pressure is contributing to it, but that doesn't explain the whole thing. You're not losing 2.4 million barrels a week to the Keystone Pipeline being at reduced pressure. So there's a trend there that is going to be important, I think, because Cushing inventory is already pretty low, so I'm keeping a close eye on that. Gasoline building 2 million barrels. Distillates drawing down 152,000 barrels. U.S. production ticking back up 100,000 barrels to 12.9 million barrels, regaining the record level that was set just a few weeks ago. Imports 6.8 million barrels, exports 3.4 million barrels. Tape action was up in reaction to the data, but didn't even make it to a new high on the day. Then today, Monday, very curiously, Patrick, we had U.S. airstrikes in Iraq that resulted in no reaction whatsoever in either oil or gold prices at the open on Sunday evening, even though Sunday afternoon there had been airstrikes in Iraq. Very surprising there. Maybe that helped this morning, this delayed reaction. We did have a fair amount of upside today. It's actually been a real roller coaster day, up and down. And right now we're down on the day as we're speaking on Monday afternoon.
All right, let's talk gold, because what a difference a week makes. I mean, that's a pretty legit breakout, but do you think it's for real?
Well, Patrick, we have very big news for the gold bulls here, but it comes with a big caveat, and you hit the nail on the head. The question is it real yet? What we have here is a breakout from the bull flag formation that has existed in the gold chart for the last 3 months or so. It looks super bullish. I wasn't expecting it this quickly. Needless to say, I'm glad I bought a bunch of more gold down at 1452. I didn't buy as much as I probably should have. I've been holding out for 1420 to really start buying in size. Looks like I might not get it. But here's the thing, Patrick. This breakout happened on holiday thin liquidity, and it is suspect because now, as we look at still a holiday period, even though today is not actually a holiday, the price has kind of stalled here for the last couple of days, right around 1512 to 1515. Still a very significant breakout, but it's stalling, and the breakout itself happened on thin liquidity trading days where maybe somebody was gunning the price higher and it wasn't really a natural move. If it's going to retrace, it's going to have to retrace pretty darn quickly, and it hasn't yet. So if we can continue to just hold current price levels or move a little bit higher beyond the holiday into regular liquidity trading conditions, then it's pretty much confirmed. We've got a breakout. The next big test to watch for would be a break above the previous high at 1570 or whatever the number was, and could be all uphill from here. If this does turn out to be a false breakout, if you saw a closing print below 1482, that would be a very bearish indication. But frankly, Patrick, that's an outlier at this point. That's not my base case at all. I think most likely the breakout is for real.
All right, well, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yields. We continue to hover around the 1.90 level, give or take. And what's your thinking about the direction of interest rates here?
Patrick, I don't have very much new to say on Treasury yields this week. Pretty much the same story as we discussed last week. What has been on my mind, though, in fixed income is junk bonds. And, as we've discussed so many times, you don't want to just outright junk bonds because the negative carry costs so much. It's a losing trade. You got to get the timing right. But I think about the way you've structured this calendared straddle strategy on the S&P. You're setting yourself up to profit when the S&P eventually breaks to the downside, but you're not losing money on the way up because of the way you've structured the trade using options. I wonder if there's a way to overcome the negative carry on a short junk bond trade and somehow do the same thing for junk bonds. Is that something that you guys have considered looking at?
Actually, it's an interesting idea. Right now, the implied volatilities on junk bonds are actually at a multi-year low. And so it's if there was ever a time to put it on an options trade, it hasn't been much cheaper than this. But the it's still a trap in one sense that right now, like if you go back to all the last few tops on junk bonds, they end up like chopping sideways for 6 months, which is going to create theta burn no matter what. And so there's going to be a carry, whether it's on time premium or whether it's the fact that you're short the underlying and have that big negative carry. But the volatility premiums are very cheap. And so right now we have a strangle on them, and because the call options are just so cheap to hedge the upside on it, and you could carry it, but it's still going to be a little bit tricky trying to catch the real turn point, right?
And just a reminder to our listeners, if you're not familiar with all of these fancy options trades Patrick teaches people how to use, just go to bigpicturetrading.com and sign up for a free trial.
All right, this week's featured interview guest is Dr. Pippa Malmgren. Why did we invite Pippa back for the final show of the decade?
Well, that's exactly it, Patrick, the final show of the decade. And I feel like of all of the people that we have on this program, Pippa is our best long-term, big-picture thinker. She usually doesn't have an opinion, and frankly, it's not even her field of knowledge to know what the S&P is going to do next week or even next month. But the big picture of trends in society and what's happening and where we're headed and what comes next, she's so good at that stuff. And I just thought that it would be good to get out of the nitty-gritty day-to-day and into big picture just to close the decade out. She's the best person I could think of to do that. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In the past, the founder and host, Niels Kastrup Larsen, has provided Macro Voices listeners with some really good resources. But I think you'll agree with me that this time, he's really outdone himself with a brand new third edition to his Ultimate Guide to Systematic Trading Books. Now, this latest edition isn't limited to just quant trading books. It's actually a comprehensive guide to many of the best investing books ever written. And right now, Macro Voices listeners can get a free copy of this excellent guide to all the best investing books by going to toptradersonplug.com/macro guide. And if you haven't heard it yet, be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your research roundup email. Check out toptradersonplug.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Dr. Pippa Malmgren is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now as Macro Voices' final interview guest for this decade is Dr. Pippa Malmgren. Pippa, you have been just on the leading edge of so many things. I think it was 2, maybe 3 years ago, you first started talking about quantum computing, and nobody knew what the hell you were talking about. And of course, today, it's one of the hottest stories going. You were really on the leading edge of that. Now, recently, you've been paying attention to something called the knowledge doubling curve. What does that mean?
So there's a guy called Buckminster Fuller. He's the one who invented the geodesic dome. And he was a remarkable scientist who estimated that by the year 1900, the information, the knowledge of the human race was increasing at a rate of about twice every 250 years. In other words, every 250 years, you would double the knowledge of the human race. But by 1900, it was doubling every century. In other words, much faster. By 1945, he said it was doubling every 25 years. And by 1982, doubling every 12 to 13 months. And then IBM did an estimate that by 2020, which is what we're right on the brink of, human knowledge would be doubling every 12 hours. Now, just everybody for a moment, think about how are you going to comprehend the world that you're trying to invest your hard-earned money into if the knowledge base of all humanity is doubling every 12 hours? What can you know? You know, it's kind of that Donald Rumsfeld, the unknown unknowns. You think you know because you've studied, you've practiced your field or your profession, your area of expertise. So you feel confident that you know something about, I don't know, call it the shipping industry. And yet, if this is what's going on, if we are having a knowledge doubling curve that by 2020 is doubling our knowledge of everything every 12 hours, you can't possibly keep up with that. And so it raises, to my mind, a lot of questions about what are the handrails we currently hold on to that might not be sound anymore. And I like shipping it as an example because, you know, some over 90% of the world's commerce travels by ship. And therefore, we think it's a really good proxy for understanding flows in the world economy. You know, what's happening to GDP? If the Baltic shipping index falls, we all think that's a pretty good indicator that slowdown is coming, for example. But in recent years, it's become disconnected and the shipping numbers are not, they're not correlating with the outcomes in the way everybody expected. And I think it's because, you know, as a person who's in the world of manufacturing myself and 3D printing and laser sintering technology. And, you know, I can send the designs and have them made anywhere in the world without putting anything on a ship. And does that mean that no business is occurring? No, it may mean that much more business is occurring than ever before, and none of it is showing up in the shipping numbers. So this is just one example of what kind of mental constructs have we created that we think are real, but if you're honest with yourself, if we're doubling our knowledge every 12 hours, they just don't hold true anymore. And I know, you know, everybody on this show, they're active investors. There are, you know, at the cutting edge of what's happening to price movements. But I do think there's a danger at this juncture in history if we don't step back for a minute and think about these dramatic changes on the landscape, and instead we're all caught up in individual price movements because we're comfortable there. But in fact, the landscape that it's based on is so profoundly changing that we then get blindsided by what's coming.
Well, needless to say, Pippa, it's a staggering statistic that human knowledge is doubling every 12 hours. But let's talk a little bit more about what that means. How is it doubling? Because we're not getting a new theory of relativity every 12 hours. Now, I would imagine that a really big chunk of this must be the collection and monetization of personal data, a subject that you've talked about quite a bit in the past. I was just reading an article the other day about how there are now these maps, these public websites that know every Wi-Fi network. You know, you set up a little Wi-Fi network in your house. Somebody's tracking you. They know how many devices are in your house talking to your Wi-Fi network, because there collectively are these apps running around on smartphones that are listening in and paying attention to who's got, you know, what number of devices connected to their network. It's really scary how much personal data is collected. Another aspect of this, something I've seen in my work, is a few years ago, the analysis, what people call big data in finance, was all about market data. What did the S&P trade at yesterday? What was the high print and so forth? Now we've got entire companies being launched, like Refinitiv, that are expanding the base of this data that finance people process with their Python programs. And it's got all kinds of data sets that's, you know, things like the voting habits of people in South Dakota. You name it, the data is being collected and saved and processed by somebody. And it seems like there's a lot of consequences and implications to what kind of data is growing. So what are some other examples? What is this doubling of human knowledge consist of every 12 hours?
Well, I think it's so interesting when you opened and you said, you know, we're not getting a new theory of relativity every 12 hours. And actually, I have to tell you, we are. We are genuinely. What is happening in physics today is that we're getting completely new theories that are breaking apart our understanding of Einstein's relativity as being simply not accurate any longer. I mean, there's a fascinating new laser system. It's called LIGO, and it's focused on gravitational waves. And all I can tell you is I've been a little deep in this subject just because I find it interesting. And what you find is that we're in a moment of history where the physicists are all having this fascinating discussion about all the new possible theories of relativity to replace the old one that we now know doesn't work, because our capacity to gather the data from the far reaches of the universe and at the nanotechnology level is so advanced because of what? Because of this doubling of knowledge. It's the input of the data flow and the speed at which you can run the algorithms over it and therefore arrive at a discovery process. This is exactly what I mean. And if it's happening to the theory of how does the universe work, you can imagine it's happening to every single other thing. Now, you talked about the Internet of Things devices and the general subject of surveillance capitalism, which is the business of gathering all kinds of data about every person, every place, every thing, every literally motion and emotion. And I think people are only just beginning to comprehend how much information about themselves is not only gathered, but already present on the internet and sold and used by the companies that are trying to sell us stuff or even hire us. Hiring decisions are increasingly made on the basis of your digital twin, not on the basis of the interview with you. In fact, you're not even getting an interview anymore because your digital twin has already disqualified you from the interview process. So these have genuine implications, not only for our personal lives, but again, how do you invest in a world that's so driven by these algorithmic practices by this business of data processing. And I would argue that the answer is we have to be much more focused on patterns than on data points. And we have to get much better at not looking back in history for past data, thinking that it will tell us something about the future, and instead get much better at how to look at the future without the benefit of the data point, but with other skills that humans have, but we don't emphasize too much. Like, it sounds awkward to say in a modern world economy, things like your instinct actually have meaning and value in this environment. And there was a great author writing in the 1960s called Marshall McLuhan, who wrote The Message is the Medium. And he always said, the artists are the greatest radar of society. Artists always give you a heads up on what is coming. And I remember just before we saw the Yellow Vest movement in France, the protests and the riots with, you know, French people putting on a yellow vest to symbolize that they were just a common person, the French fashion houses were showing riot wear, literally the fashion that was being displayed. It was a few seasons ago. All of a sudden, it was like flak jackets, camouflage, as if someone was in something like what happened in Hong Kong. And I remember at the time going, oh, watch this space. The fashion designers feel conflict coming, and they are designing clothes to reflect that. And sure enough, 3 years later, we see this live in the streets of Hong Kong. So I'm really interested in what are artists telling us? Now, most people in financial markets, they're like, I have no time for art. Don't be ridiculous. I'm trying to be a serious investor here. And I'm telling you, to be a serious investor, you need to spend more time looking at art, because if knowledge is doubling every 12 hours, you can't read enough to keep up. But art is a way of conveying a huge amount of information about reality without needing words to convey it. In other words, it's like a compressed symbol system. And what we wear are symbolic of zeitgeist. And so I think people in financial markets are not typically very good at processing information in a non-numerical, non-linear, non-reading kind of way. But in this new 2020 going forward world, with the doubling of information every 12 hours, you have to learn this new language and vocabulary.
Let's come back to that knowledge doubling curve, because something I've always known you to be really good at, Pippa, is translating these high-level abstract concepts into actionable ideas that directly relate to financial markets and the economy. So when we talk about this idea of knowledge doubling, one thing you alluded to is, okay, so all of a sudden the Dow Transports Index doesn't have the meaning it used to have because things don't need to be shipped in order to be used by someone else. You can send information over the internet and 3D print the part without shipping anything. What are some of the other consequences, and particularly the things that investors should be thinking about in terms of how to understand what this means?
Well, the first thing is the most, like, it's like the foundation stone of finance, which is monetary policy. And I still struggle with what the heck is monetary policy if you have digital currencies and if they're sovereign crypto, which is what the Chinese have announced, the EU has announced, the British are looking at that. And fundamentally, look, we've already gone from paper money to electronic money, and everybody knows that, and you don't pay for very many things with cash anymore. But digital money, that's a different thing. It's not just that it's electronic, it's that it's no longer connected to volume, because you can create units of digital money with a keystroke. So then what the heck is happening to the monetary supply when you can have or double the amount of money in the system with a keystroke? Add to that your Internet of Things comment about the data that they take about every household. If I think back to when I was in the White House and we did this like $300 tax break for every family in America at the time, and we said that. Now, how do we send that? Well, at the time, U.S. government sends you basically a check in the mail. today, if I were working for a government that had the most sophisticated data systems, which none of them do, but they will, but if I could do it today with today's technology, I could identify specific households. I could say, I want to give a tax break only to households that earn between this much and that much, that only have two children or have children, but they're a particular kind of kid, let's say a certain disability or a certain gift that the child has. And I only want to reward houses that are on my team philosophically, not on the other guy's team. So, you know, pick one side of the aisle, as it were. In other words, the specificity and granularity with which you can target and then deliver that tax break directly into somebody's bank account, like right now, this minute. And that ability to create a reward system that's so immediate and so at the will of politicians, you know, this is my question. What kinds of controls will we put in place on government policymakers? Because I think, I mean, this is like nirvana. If you're a politician, you mean I can print money anytime I want? Answer, yes, actually. And look, we just recently had Alan Greenspan come out and say inflation is coming. And why? Because we've just added so much money into the system. Look at the budget, look at the deficit spending, look at the federal budget in the United States, but frankly, everywhere else in the world as well. Look at the amount of defense spending that's going on, which is kind of quantitative easing through the back door. If you really add it all up, and now we overlay that with the capacity to double the money supply whenever you feel like it, clearly inflation becomes a bigger issue that we need to think about. And yet, if knowledge is doubling every 12 hours, the compression on prices by innovation, that technology prevents prices from rising too much because it's constantly innovating, puts us in a very interesting narrow space where you maybe get more volatility in a lower amplitude than in the past. You know, you don't repeat the great inflations of the past where you got, you know, 10,000% inflation. This might be a world where we get, you know, 2% or 5% inflation, but it's a more violent, more volatile path from 2 to 5 than, you know, if it were a wider band. I think maybe these are some of the things to think about.
Pippa, when we talked a little bit off the air about this knowledge doubling curve, you mentioned a concept called ephemeralization. What does that mean and what are its consequences and implications?
Yeah, so this is this wonderful idea, like I said, Buckminster Fuller, of doing more and more with less and less until eventually you can do everything with nothing. And we've seen this in lots of ways. I mean, his original example was Henry Ford's assembly line, where you could keep making products at a lower cost with no upper bound on the productivity. And what he was doing was just extrapolating that into the whole of the human development experience. So as an example, Airbnb, right? It's been a great story and everybody's taken advantage of it and saved money using it. But imagine that brought to businesses, not, you know, going on vacation or a business trip, but an actual business like a pop-up restaurant, where now you'll be able to, instead of having to commit to one location for your restaurant and you have to sign a lease for a year, you could actually use an Airbnb type structure to say, I want to be in Paris in this location for 2 days. Then I want to be in Tokyo in this location for these 3 days. And you create an ecosystem of businesses that only want a temporary position. And that gives them the opportunity to test out their idea. They get to see if there's a real audience. They learn a lot from that process, but without having to have the massive overheads. And now I don't know anyone who's created that yet, but I can tell you that's coming. It's bound to happen. And that's an example of this ephemeralization that, you know, instead of being constrained by resources, you actually have ubiquity as the outcome. And this is a very new way of thinking. I mean, all of modern economics is based on the assumption that everything is driven by scarcity, right? The supply-demand curve is driven by volume. How much of it is there? Well, now, if it doesn't matter, because you can have as much as you want whenever you want, including money being digital, you can just create it out of nothing, that what does that do to the value of assets, to the way we invest capital and expect a return on it? And so I think right now, you know, this is the time of year when everybody's going, well, what do you think is going to happen in the new year? Should I be long, short? Should I be this, that? Which sectors? I think this concept, ephemeralization, that's what we should think about. And how are we going to make money in an environment where everything is becoming more ephemeral, less tangible, less easy to comprehend and to process? And by the way, Bucky Fuller, when he was writing about this, he talked about moving into, and this is a big leap in my thought process, but he talked about being able to perceive things that the human body can't normally perceive. That as you get more information and things become more ephemeral, you have to become more alert. And that means being aware of things that you can't visually process, like X-rays, for example. And we are all more aware of X-rays, right? Everybody knows that now if you take a lot of long-distance flights, especially over the North Pole, you're getting X-ray damage, right? I mean, I travel all over the world all the time. Everybody knows that there are health issues. And when you go through one of these scanners at the airport, there are things happening. We're aware of them in a way that we weren't aware of them in the past. And even though we can't perceive an X-ray, we now know it's there. We can't perceive, for example, the huge debate about 5G, right? The question is, what does it do to your health to have these waves passing through a human that have different characteristics than the kinds of data transferring waves we've had in the past? And there's a big debate about this. So this is the thing, becoming aware of things that you can't perceive directly, but nonetheless, there's content and meaning. And I'll finish by saying, I think one of the things we all need to learn is how to gather information without reading. And that means becoming more adept at using symbols, which everybody's already doing in the form of emoticons, which are really just a compression of information into a very narrow, highly efficient point. Because if you try to write out what an emoticon means, especially if you pick an obscure one, you'll find it take your whole paragraph, and even still, you haven't quite described exactly what that one little picture conveys. And also receiving information that's more haptic, for example. This is the last on this subject, but an investable idea. Everybody knows sports are huge, right? But esports are now much bigger than regular live human sports. And most people who are over the age of 30 don't even know what that means. They're like, Pippa, what the heck is esports? And the answer is, this is when literally billions of people around the world get online to watch someone who is actually competing in an electronic sport over a computer console. And this has become so huge that the sponsorships are bigger than they are for the NFL or the baseball league or any other human sport. Now, in that world, haptics are coming, which means the ability to put on a jacket or a vest, and you don't just get to watch the play, you get to feel what those players are feeling as they, say, smash into each other. And you can set it. You say, I want to feel 1/10 of what they're feeling because, you know, I don't want to really take the full hit here. Or you could say, you could be with your friends and getting a little drunk and say, ah, let's see if we can handle it, right? And I imagine a few people are going to end up in the hospital this way. But what I'm describing is a world where haptic information has a value. And I am scouring the net and seeing every day more and more examples of technologies that deliver the data either through some kind of symbol or some kind of knowledge transfer that is not reading. It's virtual reality. It's augmented reality. It's imagery. It's photogrammetry. It's visual or haptic or auditory. But what it's not is reading. It's not in a report that's written by words. And I would ask this audience, how much of your information about the world we live in comes from words that are presented in a linear fashion on a page, whether on the screen or on paper? And I would venture that most people still are getting most of their information that way, which means they're already behind.
Pippa, you called it. I'm not only over 30, but over 30 by a larger margin than I care to admit on the air. So if I understood you correctly just a minute ago, because you really caught my attention, playing computer games, something I discovered at the age of 12, back when it all happened on one little computer, in the 90s, that evolved to where you were playing computer games against other players over the internet. If I heard you correctly, you're saying that has now evolved into a spectator sport, which is bigger than the NFL as measured in dollars and cents spent on advertising. Did I hear that right, first of all? And if so, okay, who's spending all these dollars? Who's making money from this? Is it a public company? What's the ticker symbol?
Exactly. You didn't mishear me, and this is correct. They say that esports by 2020, meaning now, is already a $1.5 billion industry insofar as they can track it. But the competitors are competing for prizes in any single sport for as much as $24 million. So can you imagine, the prize pools already are bigger than most real live sports. And the advertising sponsorship has gone insane. People are loving reaching young audiences that are truly global in nature by, you know, sponsoring visually. Because remember, now we don't have to actually produce anything. You don't need a poster or even to broadcast on some physical electronic poster. No, now you're just in internet land. So you can put your Coca-Cola bottle wherever you want in that space. So there are lots of different ways to get involved in that space. I'm studying it myself to really understand it. You know, in London, where I live, there's this thing called the Gfinity Arena that holds tournaments of various kinds. And people go to physical places to watch this. So like in Beijing, the national stadium gets used a lot. So imagine all these people go to a stadium to watch on VR goggles something that's not in the stadium. In other words, they're all going to watch nothing except what they can see online. And they could have stayed home to do that, but it's somehow more exciting to physically get together with all these other gamers, which means you get actual popcorn sales as well. So it's crazy getting your head around it. And there are platforms like Twitch, which is where you can stream yourself playing video games and attract followers. And this is how this esports world got started. And there's recently been the allegation by the United States that some of the platforms, like the Chinese platform called Fortnite, are actually not really about delivering cool sports to the audience. That's just the excuse. That really what they're doing is gathering an immense amount of data about the users, including, by the way, your eye movements inside the goggles, which tell you a huge amount about your emotional state of mind, your propensity to respond to things in a particular way. And that's incredibly useful for selling you stuff. So I don't know. I think it's a super interesting, fast growing, high volume, big value space. And if I were a professional investor, I would not want to miss what is happening here.
Pippa, I want to shift gears now and go back to something else you said that caught my attention, which is the world that we live in, where these unelected central bank policymakers can literally conjure trillions of dollars out of thin air. Ray Dalio has so eloquently described the market environment that we've been in for the last decade, as saying basically what's going on, central banks are buying bonds on the open market. that puts money into the hands of institutional investors who turn around and use that money to buy other investments, most notably the stock market. And that's the reason we've had the biggest bull market in recorded history over the last decade. What Ray Dalio has predicted is that that era of central bank dominance over financial markets ultimately is unsustainable and has to come to an end. And the big question mark is, okay, so what's the catalyst that brings it to an end? And it seems to me, and this, I'm so excited to ask you about this because it's so up your alley, it seems to me this is entirely about social mood and a change of public perception. My prediction is what's going to change all of this will be the politicization of monetary policy, where some politicians start to say, look, central bankers have proven over the last decade that you can conjure money out of thin air, trillions of dollars at a time. And there were a lot of critics in the beginning that said it would lead to runaway inflation, and it didn't. You can do this. It's possible to create this money and use it for something, and all they've used it for is to give it to rich people. We need to turn the tables, and we need to create essentially helicopter money, QE for the people. We need to fund universal basic income, free college tuition, forgiveness of tuition loans, and probably a large number of other social programs by changing the game so that quantitative easing continues but is no longer used to buy bonds on the open market the way it's been used in the past. First question is, would you agree with me that this is the kind of catalyst that potentially could change the entire game for financial markets? And if so, you're the expert on social moods and feedback loops and so forth. What would it take to bring these kinds of things about, and how do you see this playing out?
I entirely agree with this. And I think we really need to understand this new digital money will not exist in a vacuum. It will be immediately tied to individual people, individual addresses, individual GPS locations. So again, I come back to when I was in the White House and we, you know, wanted to give money back to the public. Today, my ability to know, for example, I could, if I were a policymaker, I could say, I would like to reward all, say, Americans who run 3 times a week, because I really think that this is the way we're going to diminish the healthcare cost burden. And so I want to incentivize people to look after their physical health. And therefore, this tax cut or this, you know, financial allocation from the government, whatever you want to call it, this will only give to people whose Fitbits or sports, you know, wearables are showing that they run 3 times a week. And this is not, I mean, this is now totally within our reach. And if we add, by the way, blockchain to this picture, which inevitably is what's going to happen, blockchain as a technology is a little bit slow and unwieldy, but, you know, over time, you'll be able to geolocate every person and all the motions and movements that they make in a particular place at a particular time. And so even if you're not wearing a Fitbit, the fact that you're running and your phone is in your pocket revealing that you're running starts to get counted. And so the question is, what the heck does this do to the structure of society when politicians can allocate those rewards and those penalties, not just so freely, which is your point, that they can just, as you say, conjure forth money out of absolutely nothing and have no consequences. So of course they're going to love that. But I'm saying take it to another level, allocate it on the basis of your thoughts, your behaviors, your level of compliance or adherence to their particular political persuasion. That's what is really going to be happening. And I just think this part we haven't begun to think about. Because imagine, again, if I'm a politician, now I know I can double the money supply, I can with one keystroke and have no inflationary consequences or not enough to anybody complain about. And I can target that money to go to everyone who I perceive to be a swing voter to pull them into my camp. That is what we're talking about. That's the level of power and omnipresence in the economic life of the voter that we have never seen before.
You know, as you were talking, it occurred to me that another potential ramification of all this is if you look at what's gone on with privacy, you know, we've got certain protections, not a lot, frankly. The Constitution certainly still allows some things. And after Edward Snowden's disclosures, there was a little bit of a clampdown. Well, what if they changed the game and said, look, we can't force you to give us all of your personal data. Some of that is still protected by the Constitution, and we can't force you to give it over to us. We're not going to make you do it. But if you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to lose. So what you really ought to do is voluntarily opt in to total surveillance and qualify for a tax break by doing so. There's nothing illegal about that.
This is super interesting, and you're right. This is one possibility, is you opt into everything and you allow your digital twin to fully reveal everything about yourself because you have nothing to hide. But my concern is that actually, in a sense, you may have something to hide. Let me describe. It's a simple example, but, you know, now that Google and MasterCard have a deal, so everything I buy on my MasterCard, Google gets to see what that was. And so, you know, if I'm buying Ben and Jerry's ice cream at midnight on a Thursday night on Uber Eats, and it's clear that I'm sitting in my living room and maybe Googling at the same time, I don't know, Weight Watchers and thinking I really need to get on the running machine, you know, all of that is now visible. And at the same time, let's say your partner is in Las Vegas and they're buying, I don't know, as a really, you know, compelling example to get people to pay attention, they're buying lingerie for somebody in a size 4. Now, suddenly the algorithms can see that there's a mismatch there and they will pick up and they will literally alert the bank that a divorce is becoming much more likely in this household and start cutting the credit limit of the lower earning partner, who then goes to apply for a job because the divorce is real and no one will interview. And it's usually her. It's usually not him. No one will interview her because all this same data is available. And basically it shows that you're not emotionally stable. So you say, I have nothing to hide. But the question is, how much are the algorithms presuming about what is, quote, normal behavior? And how much latitude is there? And one of the things that scares the devil out of me is that we are blindly marching into a world where you have almost a kind of, you know, we talk about genetic engineering, the people in the future. Well, this is social engineering, where you create a system that rewards people who are, you know, highly athletic and running 3 times a week, but doesn't give any credit to somebody who writes poetry because it's not valued by the system in the same way. And this is a point that Yuval Hariri makes in his book, Sapiens. And it's a very compelling point. He basically says, look, who's got the money right now to develop all these algorithms and data gathering structures and companies? You know, that's Silicon Valley and it's the military. And what are they going to focus on? What's the ideal human from their point of view? Well, that's a person who's very physically strong in the military, highly efficient, very rational, responds to orders without questions, you know, this type of thing. Is that where we want our society to go? Or if we look the other direction, Silicon Valley rewards people who might have a particular political outlook or, again, a particular approach to health and well-being that maybe isn't shared by large parts of the population. So this, it's got a social engineering quality to it, which I think will have enormous implications for individuals and for society at large that, you know, we're just not thinking about. And again, as an investor, this is important because if you don't understand this piece, I don't know how you can make money because you won't be able to tell which businesses are going to do well and which are going to do poorly if you can't understand that this is the construct that we're operating in.
Pippa, something else that you said a few minutes ago is in the future, people will get more information, not by reading, but through other means of communication. And it made me think about another conversation we had in another interview a while back, where we talked about not VR, virtual reality, but something else called AR, augmented reality. I know you've been following that and probably other trends, so I'll broaden it to generally, if it's not reading, how is it that people will receive information? How's the world going to change in terms of how we all process information?
Yeah. So one of the things in my robotics business where I'm making aerial drones and autonomous vehicles that gather data, we've started working with a company called Epson that provide augmented reality glasses. And they're so interesting. You can have your regular glasses on, and these will go over them, or you can just wear them straight. And if you're on a construction site, let's say, you can now be standing in the construction site. You can see that construction site crystal clear because it's right in front of you, but you can also see the data overlay. You can see all the measurements of all the piping. What is the material that it's made of? What's the volume of fluid that's passing through pipes already in that building? What are the stresses and tensions on the building that are already beginning to cause cracks in the infrastructure? In other words, it's this, what I've talked about is the fourth dimension. You know, 3D is one thing. To see your asset in 3D is one thing. But I'm talking about where you extract the data, and now you can look at that asset strictly through the data lens. And that's like a different universe. You know, Einstein talked about the fourth dimension as being time. Well, this is what I'm saying. We now have the capacity to break the linear arrow of time, because you can go back to a moment in the past and look at that same building and see exactly where those micro fractures were happening that led to a beam collapsing, let's say. You don't have to guess when did this start. You'll be able to see exactly when it started. And similarly, you can jump into the future because you can probabilistically begin to predict when is the fracture likely to result in the shearing of a beam. And in this way, get in front of accidents and prevent them before they happen. But the fourth dimension is also where, you know, the Victorians used to think of it as where ghosts and spirits resided. And in a sense, this is what we're seeing, is the fourth dimension data is the digital spirit of the person or the place or the thing or the building. And so all of that information is being gathered visually through images, not through reading a report about the building. It's from, and what I envisage is people will sit in the boardroom at headquarters in New York, and they will literally pick up, instead of picking up a board report that's written on A4 paper and printed, they will pick up these glasses and they will look at their assets all over the world through glasses. And all the data will be accessible to them on their mobile phone, where they can bring up deeper dive into that site. And everybody will start to confer without ever having looked at a report that contains words. And that's what I mean.
And I just want to encourage our listeners who may not be familiar with this, because it's very hard to conceptualize without being able to see it. Go to YouTube and type in augmented reality and take a look at some of the demo videos that they have on technology that's already available and shipping today, because it is either amazingly impressive or amazingly scary, depending on your perspective. And just to sort of describe what this is like, if you imagine some of those, like the Terminator movies, where the Terminator, who's supposed to be a robot, is looking at a human being and they see these data blocks coming up next to them. This is who this person is, their date of birth, their current heart rate, their whatever. That's real now. That technology exists. So if I go to a meeting with you to negotiate with you, I look at you and coming up next to your head is a little data block that says this guy's last 12 deals. This is how many points of negotiation he made before he caved to the deal. It's looking at your facial expressions, running them through an artificial intelligence engine and figuring out when you're lying, when you're at the truth. When you tell me, look, this is the bottom line. This is as far as I can go. I know whether you're telling the truth or not because I've got a huge amount of computing horsepower that is analyzing your facial expressions. And I might be doing this wearing some covert kind of device that you're not even aware of, that I can see through, who knows? I mean, right now it's eyeglasses, but it could be contact lenses in the future. It's scary stuff. What are some of the other consequences, both good and bad, of what this technology could mean for society?
Yeah, you know, one of the things I've been following is how the Chinese are using it with their social credit system. And one aspect of it that I've found particularly sort of intriguing and potentially worrying is linking all of this data that's required as a citizen. And, you know, now they're saying you have to have facial recognition to access the internet in China. So you really can't get online unless you properly identify who you are. Linking all that data to dating apps. So literally when someone is going to do internet dating, which is, you know, how most people do this these days, they can see, do you pay your bills on time? You know, how do you behave in relationships? What was the length of your last relationship? What kind of divorce did you have? Here are the publicly available papers about your divorce. I mean, literally, this is where we're going, that the depth of information about, you know, again, how many times did this person order Uber Eats Baked Alaska ice cream after the divorce, and how did that trail off in the following few years, right? It's this stuff is already accessible. And all that's going to happen in the coming decade is it's going to become easier for regular folks like you and me to access that kind of information about each other. And so, again, I come back to how do you invest in a world if you don't really understand this piece of the puzzle? Because this is where the profits are going to be made. This is where the juice is extracted and comprehended. But it's also where your personal life is going to be driven by these things, the hiring, the firing, the marriages, the dating, the, you know, the interfacing with any kind of organization where you're now carrying your medical records with you everywhere, which in many ways is a massive advance that's going to save lives. But it's also a world where your medical records are more visible to, it's hard to keep them as contained and private as they have been. So what do we do with the folks in society who do have real medical problems, who can't keep a relationship going? Does that make them not worthy of spending time with? What kind of judgment calls have we made? And that's one thing that just worries me. And I know I've quoted on this your show before, but I love that line from Frank Zappa, the rock star, who said, you know, progress comes from deviating from the norm. And if we're going to create a society where we're really asking everybody to comply with whatever rules of the road that we think are appropriate, the fact is compliance is antithetical to innovation and progress and disruption and creation, the act of creation. So for these reasons, yeah, you're quite right to point out, you know, the person you're talking to can read you now in a way that they never did before. By the way, facial recognition technology is already being used in regular retail high street shops, not just to recognize who is a thief and who has a record of stealing from shops, and then they get an alert saying that you're in the shop, and you usually get surrounded by bodyguards who make it uncomfortable for you to stay. But in addition, they can pull up your whole purchasing history. What did you buy in here when you came last? And that way the person comes up to you and says, we have some amazing new scarves. And you're like, well, actually, the last time I was here, I bought a scarf. Funny that. You know, it completely changes the relationship between companies and customers and between states and citizens.
Pippa, a final subject I've been dying to ask you about, because I know that you have been very closely following the way that different generations are evolving and the way that they think differently about society and about the future. And I know you've been very, very optimistic about the way that younger generations are going to maybe solve problems that our generation didn't know how to solve by taking new approaches. Something I've noticed, though, just in the last 6 months, this phrase, okay, boomer, has come into vogue with young people. And basically what I see it as, and I think it's justified in many respects, is Generation Z is waking up to the fact that their parents' and grandparents' generation was not particularly responsible with not funding all of these entitlement programs. So all of a sudden, the fact that we've got baby boomers retiring and there's not enough money to pay for their retirement, that's something that baby boomers have been following, that trend, and the fact that Social Security is underfunded and so forth for many years. But what we're seeing now is teenagers, people in their early 20s, are looking at this and saying, wait a minute, these people voted for all these benefits where they get money that I have to pay for, and they didn't do any saving during their working years to pay for it. It all has to come out of my working years. I don't think so. Where is this headed? Are we headed potentially for, I think back to late 1960s, the generational divide in society where people under 30 and people over 30 didn't get along with each other that well. Are we headed toward another version of that, or another generation gap in society?
Yeah, and I think these generation gaps are, again, hugely important for investors to understand, because you can make a lot of money once you comprehend them. So one aspect of this is, so I'm a boomer, and so I get the okay boomer means you guys are just so clueless that I can't even explain this to you. Like, even if I tried to explain it, you won't get it. So I understand, and part of that is because, you know, the younger generation who have had smart devices in their pocket since they were tiny, they are literally able to access more computational power than we needed to put a man on the moon in the 60s, because that's what's in an iPhone today. More computational power than we had to put a human on the moon. So the old notion a boomer has that knowledge and wisdom are a function of age, it no longer applies. And again, back to the doubling of the knowledge curve, who is at the front end of that doubling process? That's younger people, because they're more adept at extracting that information, finding it, being aware that it where it is and where it's occurring. So now the young don't equate age with wisdom. In fact, quite the opposite. They think the old people are clueless. And now it's a different thing. They want to displace them. And so they bring a lot of knowledge, but is knowledge and wisdom the same thing? I would argue, no, it's not. So we're going to find out in the coming years amongst the younger Gen Z and millennials how they learn to discern the difference between having a lot of knowledge and big data and wisdom. And I don't know if that's a function of age or not, but that's definitely one fulcrum on which this generational argument turns. Another one, which I find super interesting, is what I would call holistic versus Cartesian. The Cartesian way of thinking is what we've had ever since Descartes said, basically, if you keep cutting reality up into ever smaller bits, if you ask ever more precise questions, you divide in order to find answers. So you make everything quantitative, so it's mathematical and subject to computational analysis, quantitative analysis. And if you just go deeper, you'll find the answer. So the origin of being highly analytical is to buy into this Cartesian notion that if I can't put a number on it, it's not real. Well, that's a very boomer idea. And the younger crowd, they're going the other direction. They're saying, you know what? There may be answers when you go down into an analytical thought way, but we have to think holistically about the whole planet. And actually, every decision that you make here has a consequence there. So a boomer can say, let's make iPhones, and we don't really care about the folks in Africa who are extracting some of the metals that are required, that's really toxic and kills them at an early age and makes their environment awful. And then we dump those iPhones when we're done using them in some place that creates all kinds of new health hazards for the people who never even had a chance to use them. Boomers are okay with that. Younger generation are not. They're thinking, what are the consequences of this decision to use an iPhone? Who gets hurt along the way? This is way beyond the stakeholder thought process. This is a holistic way of thinking. And I do find that this gap is so big, it's just almost impossible to overcome. In fact, you know, Thomas Kuhn, who wrote that wonderful analysis of scientific revolutions, I can't remember when did Thomas Kuhn write. Was it in the 1700s or the 1800s? But anyway, Kuhnian thinking was that when there's a paradigm shift, the people in the old paradigm can never make the jump to the new one because they're so constrained by the thought processes they already have. They can't break free enough to see what is the new paradigm. And I wonder whether this is one of those issues as well. I don't know. Personally, as a boomer, I'm making a very big effort to break free of my, my predetermined notions of reality. But I have to say, it's a lot of work, like a lot of work. And you have to read and you have to not just read, but as I was saying before, experience. I have to say, if I hadn't experienced virtual reality and augmented reality as a business tool, not as a fun thing to play with, but as something that genuinely changes how you perceive and find value in things, I really wouldn't be able to comprehend half of what's going on out there. So it's again, how do you improve your sensory perception capabilities? And so I have a couple of recommendations on that I'll just finish with. And one is find music that you really modern music, like something that's happening right now that you really don't like. And then study that. Listen to it. Listen to versions, different variations of it. Try to understand what is it that other people are moved by. And I think what you'll find is as you do this, your sensory perception is actually a remarkable tool, and it does like novelty, and it will start to absorb something like a song that you couldn't bear because your teenager was listening to it. And you're like, do we have to listen to this? Can we turn this off? That song could become your most favorite song, but it's a thought process that you have to engage in. And this is just a reminder to us that, you know, when the ancient Greeks invented the term technology, tech, it was originally the word techne. And what techne meant was not a thing, but a thought process. And I think that most of us boomers need to widen out our thought process. And the way you do that is by trying things that you genuinely don't like. Music is an easy one. Trying food that you just thought, there's no way I'm ever going to like this. And suddenly you begin to understand, why is there such a big business in vegetarian food these days? Well, when you try it, actually the quality of vegetarian food has become so remarkably good that even people who are not vegetarians are going, hey, there's something happening here and I'm buying it. And boom, now you got an investment story into the whole vegan vegetarian space, which boomers are hugely dismissive of. And young people are like, okay, boomer, how can you not get this? So those are some of my thoughts.
Pippa, one final topic that I want to mention. You, of course, I think most of our listeners know, went from being a presidential advisor to entrepreneur. You run H Robotics. You actually manufacture not the toy drones that you used to, you know, take pictures with, but commercial drones that are used for surveying mining sites and all kinds of industrial applications. And I know that you're engaged in thinking out of the box. So I want to get your vision of the future. How are remote-controlled or even self-controlled unmanned autonomous vehicles going to change the future? What are the things nobody's thought of yet that are maybe over the horizon that you're looking forward toward?
Totally. Yeah, I'm so deep in this subject. And what's so interesting is when people say, when I say we make autonomous vehicles, everyone immediately assumes that means you're making cars. But actually, no, I make autonomous vehicles that are for transporting cameras and sensors and devices, things like lights, not about moving a person. In fact, the whole point is to remove the person and get them out of dangerous tasks and out of repetitive tasks that humans don't really do very well. And I think this notion of autonomous vehicles are not about people. They're not people moving equipment. They're sensor moving equipment. And what's the purpose? It is this business of entering this fourth dimension where you have this extraordinary data-based view of reality, which is more precise and accurate than any view of reality that you'll ever have with your own eyes. And so I see extraordinary things happening in the business community as they move in this direction to being able to do everything from, you know, secure their properties by literally having better quality security against theft because of autonomous vehicles operating on the property, all the way to being able to construct buildings in entirely new ways because you have this data to work with. Doing things like managing remote assets. You know, I've talked about the tailings dams on mines, which are, you know, so horribly toxic and so dangerous. And never again should there ever be a failing of one of these tailings dams, because now you can know exactly what is the volume of fluid, what is the shape of the basin, are the liners coming unstuck, is there a leak? All of these things are completely crystal clear visible with autonomous vehicles sending sensors in, and which a human can't detect with the naked eye. So I'm very keen to have a conversation with people on the net, social media, about, you know, what are we talking about? This fourth dimension world, this world of autonomous vehicles that are gathering data, this world where quadrillions of data points are gathering to create almost like a crystal ball that we have to learn how to conjure forth answers from this new data space and to do so effectively and correctly. And I think that's an entirely new skill set that people of every age and every background are learning from scratch. I mean, in this new data space that I'm describing, in a sense, we're all illiterate. And so to that end, I'm very keen to have a chat to people. I'm on Dr. Pippa M on Twitter and Instagram. I've been a bit quiet lately, but only because I've been so busy building this company. But I'll be very active again in the new year. And also as @H_robotics, because we make helpful robotics. And very happy to talk about this whole process of automation, robotics, and why all of it's going to create more jobs than destroys, and means that our future economy is actually going to look much better than most people are currently anticipating.
And again, for any listeners who may have ideas that they want to share with Pippa about how autonomous vehicles might be used in the future, the Twitter handle is @DrPippaM. This episode was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro guide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. We're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time. I want to wish all of our listeners a safe and happy New Year's holiday. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back next year. That's also next week, right here at macrovoices.com.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.